This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, backyard meth labs are messing up the environment as well as our brains. We talk to the folk responsible for cleaning them up. In our continuing series on the origins of life, a scientist describes bacterium he is discovering in Yellowstone Hot Springs. Microbiologists are identifying thousands of organisms previously unknown to science. We're blasted by the winds on the uplands along the Grand River in South Dakota as we hike through Sioux Country with author Merrill Gilfillan. And on the Earth calendar, rattlesnakes are being collected around Sweetwater, Texas for the world's largest rattlesnake roundup. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Law enforcement officials in the Midwest and Western United States are on the front lines of a war against methamphetamine. It's an illegal drug that can be snorted, smoked, or injected, and the high the user gets is usually more intense than cocaine. The drug can destroy families and the lives of those who use it, but it is also putting added pressure on police officers as well as the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. Another issue facing state and local agencies is how to deal with the environmental effects of methamphetamine production. Stephen Westcott reports.
Methamphetamine, also known as crystal meth or just meth on the street, is unlike other drugs, such as cocaine and heroin, because it does not derive from a plant. It is made with ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, often found in cold medicines, and a host of toxic chemicals like ammonia, hydrochloric acid, and toluene, just to name a few. Some of them can cause lung damage if inhaled, others are flammable, and still others can be very dangerous if disposed of improperly, say down a toilet or sink. When police shut down a drug lab, the chemicals have to be cleaned up, and in Washington state, the number of such sites is increasing.
In 1995, it doubled to 60, and then each year, 96, 7, and 8, it went to 153, 207, and 349. In this last year. So 1995 was the pivotal year, and the amount of drug labs that we see now have increased by almost 500% since 1995.
That's Steve Hunter, supervisor of spill response with the Washington State Department of Ecology. His office is responsible for cleaning up toxic materials found at methamphetamine labs. Normally, Hunter's department responds to hazardous waste and gasoline leaks or any other type of spill where immediate cleanup is necessary. But the added burden of cleaning up more and more meth labs is putting a strain on staff members and forcing the department to prioritize potential environmental disasters on a case-by-case basis. At the time I interviewed Hunter, his office was preparing for the worst as an oil tanker stuck off the coast of Oregon threatened to leak thousands of gallons of oil onto Washington's coastline.
The very folks who needed to pay attention to early planning and the availability of people and equipment yesterday were doing five drug labs. They had folks pulled in off of... they had folks extended into the evening hours and had pulled in the nighttime crew and were chasing drug labs at the same time that were trying to make early preparations, sort of the what-if plans, for this freighter stuck on the Oregon coast.
Hunter says the burden of cleaning up an increasing number of meth labs is also taking a financial toll on the department.
Unfortunately, the local circumstance here is that the fund sources we use are actually shrinking a bit. The projections that we're getting for one account, which is called the Model Toxics Control account, is dropping. The projections are backsliding on us. And our decisions here internally have been to not take any of those cuts or those reductions in the methamphetamine cleanup staff that we're using right now.
But Hunter says his office can only do this for so long and adds the Department of Ecology is currently looking to both the state legislature and federal agencies for help in dealing with the strain of cleaning up drug labs. Washington isn't the only state fighting this war. California's Environmental Protection Agency is also being forced to clean up meth labs.
In 1996, we responded to requests for removals at 1,313 labs. In 1997, that number grew to 1,559. And for calendar year 1998, we responded to 1,687 labs. And just in January of this year, we've had a record number for any single month. We responded to 180 labs.
Arnold Sargent is senior hazardous substances scientist with California EPA's Department of Toxic Substances Control. He says unlike Washington State, Cal EPA has enough funds and staff to deal with the current level of labs being cleaned up. This is because the state contracts with private companies. Sargent says the problem some California communities are facing occurs after the initial cleanup is complete. Cal EPA will remove the bulk of the hazardous chemicals, but oftentimes some contamination is left behind in the form of spills on rugs, for example. Secondary cleanups become the responsibility of local health departments and property owners who oftentimes have no idea what to do.
And where we're finding there's really a lack of information is toxicology on drug lab chemicals, controlled substances, and the intermediate byproducts. There's just not good toxicological data or good health study data to show what the actual problems are, what the threshold of these chemicals are in terms of how much of a concentration is there necessary to be before you have a problem, or how clean do you clean it until you can now say that you can go in and safely occupy a former drug lab site. And the absence of that data is really creating a real dilemma.
Both Sargent and Arnold expect the number of meth labs will continue to rise despite efforts by law enforcement agencies. They are hopeful, though, that it will cap off at some point. Environmental degradation as a result of drug production is nothing new. In South America, rivers have been polluted from the processing of cocaine. It appears that environmental damage is yet another continuing cost of drug use. Since a meth lab can be set up virtually anywhere, every community is at risk. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Continuing our series of conversations with scientists who are studying the origins of life, my guest today is Dr. David Ward. He's professor in the Department of Land Resources and Environmental Sciences at Montana State University. He's a microbiologist and has been doing research on life that is found in some extremely warm places in Yellowstone Park. My understanding is you've been looking at microbiology in hot springs.
That's right.
What is a hot spring, and why is microbiology different in a hot spring than someplace else?
Well, I think everybody has an idea of what hot springs are. We work in Yellowstone Park. It's a place where natural thermal springs emerge on the surface of the earth. It's not a place where you'd really think about looking for living organisms, though, and I guess that's because people don't live there. Plants and animals don't live there. But if you've ever visited Yellowstone or seen pictures, you see the colors around the effluent channels of hot springs, oranges, greens, yellows, and these are actually microorganisms that live right in water that's so hot you can't even hold your hand in it.
Are we finding out things we didn't know before?
One of the things that we've learned only in the last 20 or so years is that the kinds of bacteria that live in hot springs are very, potentially at least, very old. And I won't get into the details of how it is that we've really learned this, but in essence now, by using techniques of modern molecular biology, we can try to compare living things and learn their natural relationships. We can look at how species have evolved. And one of the amazing discoveries that came out about 2 decades ago, and it's really been embellished upon in the last 20 years, is that, in fact, bacteria are comprised of two different kinds of organisms that evolved separately. And these two kinds of organisms are as different from one another as they are from human beings, for example. And yet they both fit this definition of bacteria, a simple, very tiny cell without a nucleus. So there's actually been one of the big discoveries, and it was made first by looking at organisms that live in extreme environments. Some of these extreme environments would be hot springs. We've learned that we need to subdivide our little tiny organisms without a nucleus into two classes, the bacteria and a group that we now call the archaea. And then the third major class of life is all the life that is made from cells with a nucleus.
The environment you've described, the hot spring, though, is not only hot, but I would presume at least some of them are very dark.
Even at the surface of the Earth, there are organisms, some microorganisms, that live without the traditional energy sources that we think of, again, from our human perspective. We all know about plants using light energy, and these green and orange and yellow communities of microbes in hot springs, they also use light, like plants. But there are many other kinds of bacteria and archaea that use all sorts of bizarre things for energy. I mean, we don't use light. We use, Wheaties or toast or something that's basically organic material. But some of these organisms use things like hydrogen sulfide and hydrogen gas and things that seem toxic to us. That's what they like to eat.
So where does your field of study take us in terms of a vision of the future that involves an expanded understanding of species and where they came from?
We want to know, in these green and orange and yellow communities around the hot springs, who's there? What are the organisms that inhabit those communities? And if we were to use a microscopes or petri plates, culture media, we would get a very simple answer. Wouldn't be a correct answer. Again, using molecular biology techniques to ask this question, who's there, we get an idea with a kind of a genetic fingerprint of the answer to that question. What we've discovered is that there are tons of organisms in these communities, and in fact in any natural community, that just have never been seen before by these old techniques.
You've described the process of microbiology that has indeed opened people's eyes. In very simple terms, can you explain what that process is? What is it that you're doing that was undoable before the science developed to its current state?
Yeah, basically we're seeing a lot of species that are really out in nature, but we couldn't see them before because, again, thinking about a microscope, they all look alike. Or thinking about the traditional technique of my field, microbiology, that growing of an organism in the laboratory. It's like trapping an animal or something like that. The traps don't get all the animals. So we're now, with these new molecular tools, we're beginning to see what's really out in nature, and the diversity is really amazing. For every one bacterium in a trap, a culture collection in the laboratory, there are probably 100 to 1,000, perhaps even 1,000,000 species out in nature that have never been seen before. It's a real age of discovery of microbial diversity.
What should the informed layman be looking at in terms of future developments in the field of microbiology that will have an impact on our own lives?
Another area that my lab is working on, it's what we might call applied ecology. So Homo sapiens, this wise species, is throwing a lot of things in the environment that aren't very good for us, and we'd like to clean them up. Turns out that these are good foods for many microorganisms, and for about 4 or 5 decades, we've been growing bacteria that could degrade hydrocarbons or chlorinated pesticides and things like that. But the track record is not very good of taking these trapped, contaminant-degrading bacteria, putting them back into nature to clean up a spill, a contaminated site or something. And why is that? Well, maybe it's because we haven't really understood that nature is full of a myriad of these ecologically specialized bacteria. And the one we trap out in culture isn't going to be very fit in nature. It's only fit in the laboratory environment. So we're trying to find out, in that sense, how many other kinds of contaminant-degrading bacteria are there in nature, and can we devise ways to trap those species that might be best at cleaning up an oil spill or a pesticide dump or something like that.
That was microbiologist David Ward from Montana State University. The discussion was part of our continuing series on the origins of life.
Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support for the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. You may have some ideas about where life began. Let us know. Write us at Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Merrill Gilfillan, it's the Grand River in South Dakota, where grasshoppers will fly into your mouth if you don't keep your lips pursed. In this portrait of place, Gilfillan reads from his book titled Chokecherry Places, Essays from the High Plains.
This morning, I am going out to see the South Fork of Grand River in Perkins County, South Dakota. I walk or loiter along rivers like this one so often, rally the same or similar thoughts and eyes full, that I begin to feel, this morning at any rate, and for the very first time, like John Donne with his sermons. Each time I come to the Grand River National Grasslands, once every 4 or 5 years is not enough, is admittedly devotional and tonic, and I inevitably fill pages of my pocket notebook. And the subject is always the sense of rivers and their uplands as sensual mentalities, as organisms subtle and fine, to be encountered like music or cool bay water. But for one reason or another, I have never devoted ample time to the South Fork of the Grand, and here I am today with that in mind, and oranges in my pack, and a grasslands map to pick out the public from the private lands. I select a stretch 16 or 18 miles southwest of the Shade Hill Dam and climb the fence. I walk west on the high bench for half a mile, then cut south toward the stream. Upland sandpipers flush off right and left. It is so windy this morning I have to wear sunglasses and keep my lips firmly closed to avoid the endless spray of large grasshoppers that in a 25 or 30 mile per hour wind slap hard into the face and would no doubt lodge deep in an unguarded gullet. So windy that I have to kneel and take hold of the bouncing grasses to distinguish various specimens. Were I a landscape painter, I would spend a lot of time in the Grand River country. It is a grassland landscape of endless richness and chromatic mood, elegant as the oft-painted Marin Hills of California. Today, in early August, the first of the grasses are beginning to color, break toward fall, and the scattered chaparral-like patches of chokecherry and bullberry have a slightly changed cast to them on the far hill's runnels below an expansive, crenellated skyline. Like all the Grand River terrain, it has a welling, formidable noblesse. I hike for a long hour. It would be nice to float the Grand all the way from the Shade Hill Dam to the Missouri River. Factoring in the kinks and hesitations, it would likely come to 200 canoe miles, most all of it through the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, the entire first two-thirds of the trip drifting through nearly roadless, townless prairie whose hills, come sundown, 7:30 or a quarter of eight, throw some of the finest shadows on earth. Farther upstream, the river bends sharply to the south, and the valley beyond is a vast expanse of unexpurgated prairie, where prairie dogs yap and an eagle soars. Turning south with the stream, I find the going easier with the wind now at my back, and the hopper is less threatening accordingly. I follow her till she bends westerly again at a sagebrushy, mouse-brown bluff, casts off toward the headwaters, far out beyond the Slim Buttes country, west of Buffalo. Then I take a long pull of water and turn back, against the wind, through the shank-high grasses rippling with it, flashing silken sheen like flame before it. Then I strike off for the road and the car and the bologna sandwich. The hue of the distant bullberry patches is an argent olive. At one point, slanting up toward the bluff tops again, I thought I heard someone calling my name several times in a casual, friendly way from far upwind, and actually stopped and looked a time or two. That old, inveterate, high plains Aeolian trick, always good for a laugh, eon after eon.
That was author Merrill Gilfillan reading from his book titled Chokecherry Places, Essays from the High Plains. It's published by Johnson Books. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now in Texas, western diamondbacks are being caught for the world's largest rattlesnake roundup. It's the 41st anniversary of the event, held every year on March 12 through 14. It all happens in Sweetwater, Texas, a small town with about 12,000 residents, located 50 miles west of Abilene. On the weekend of the roundup, the town will at least double in size. Scott Holman is a spokesman for the Sweetwater JCs, which sponsors the event. He says Sweetwater's roundup began when farmers and ranchers got together to address a common problem.
The snakes biting their calves, and then, you know, back then not being able to get around quick enough to get to them to treat them medically, just detrimental to their calf crops and their cow crops and just livestock in general, you know.
At the Sweetwater Roundup, venom from western diamondbacks is collected to create a serum for those who are bitten. Rattlesnakes inject their victims with poison which flows through the fangs. Western diamondbacks are not the most deadly snake in Texas, but they do remain among the most poisonous rattlers in the state. Besides collecting venom, Scott says one of the most important reasons for holding the roundup is to educate children about the hazards of playing with snakes.
One of our JCs, and his name is Rick Wilkinson, he gets in the pit and he does a demonstration with the rattlesnakes, emphasizing on safety, because we have a lot of children that attend over the weekend, and we want to emphasize that snakes are harmful, but if you do leave them alone, they generally won't bother you.
The western diamondback is probably best known for the unique diamond designs that run the length of its back. The snakes are usually brown or tan in color and have a black and white tail that rattles to warn enemies of its presence. The diamondback is the longest rattlesnake in Texas at 3 to 4 feet, but the largest ever caught was 7 feet long. They're primarily nocturnal, and even though it's the most commonly encountered rattlesnake in Texas, scientists are still gathering information about the animal. Scott Holman says the roundup helps in that effort.
The past few years, what we've been doing is about an average of about 300 snakes, and what we do is measure the snakes, weigh the snakes, and sex the snakes to determine the male or female. And with that information, the Texas Parks and Wildlife is trying to gather and get some more data on the rattlesnake. They really don't have that much information on them. Trying to figure out, you know, the ratio of male to female snakes and the average weight and the average length.
Animal rights advocates and some ecologists criticize snake roundups, saying the animals are sometimes flushed out of their dens with chemicals that harm them and all the other creatures that use the burrow. Also, they say roundups demonize snakes that are actually an important link in the ecosystem because they eat rodents and serve as food for larger animals such as coyotes and hawks. Despite the criticism, the world's largest rattlesnake roundup will continue with an array of vendors and demonstrations, as well as a barbecue rattlesnake contest. I've had barbecued rattlesnake. The meat is pretty bland. The only real bite is in the barbecue sauce. By my way of thinking, the best thing to do would be to leave the rattler alone in the wild and develop an antitoxin for the sauce. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. Continuing our look at the proposed new federal budget, an environmental coalition has published its Green Scissors report. It says billions of taxpayer dollars are being spent on programs which hurt the planet. We talk green about diesel and the diesel engine. Scientists say diesels cause cancer, and California is taking steps to reduce diesel emissions. Should the Federal Environmental Protection Agency do the same thing? We go to West Africa, where deserts are expanding. The global economy has turned forces loose which are damaging both the land and the sea. Stay with us. Members of Green Scissors 99 say irrigation subsidies to rich farmers and flood control programs run by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are just two of the more than 70 federally funded programs that should be eliminated or revised. The Green Scissors program is an annual effort by environmental, taxpayer, and consumer groups to cut wasteful and environmentally harmful subsidies. Coalition members say this year, Green Scissors could save U.S. taxpayers more than $50 billion in what they call polluter pork programs. Stephen Westcott has more.
Green Scissors is led by Friends of the Earth and has other notable environmental groups on board like Sierra Club and National Wildlife Federation. Members stress the coalition is politically neutral and includes what might be considered not so traditional environmental groups like Rep America, or Republicans for Environmental Protection, and Physicians for Social Responsibility. Taxpayers for Common Sense, or TCS, is also part of the effort to cut spending and protect the environment. Sina Swisher, Green Scissors coordinator for the watchdog group, says TCS wants to see a particular subsidy to mining companies reformed.
Under the 1872 mining law, mining companies can extract minerals without paying royalties, and they buy public lands for $5 an acre or less, basically paying 1872 prices for land that is worth billions of dollars. In the Green Scissors proposal, what we say is that there should be a fair market return to taxpayers for extraction of publicly owned minerals, and a royalty of 8% could raise roughly $1 billion over 5 years.
Another federally funded program some Green Scissors members would like to see cut is radioactive recycling. According to the coalition, the U.S. Department of Energy contracted with a British company to recycle uranium at a former atomic weapons production facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Contaminated metals like nickel and steel would be extracted and sold to other companies to make common household items.
Well, the radioactive recycling program really is a subsidy for the nuclear industry, and it would cost taxpayers more than $250 million. And it's outrageous that radioactive waste would be recycled into products that you and I could use every day, like tableware, like braces, like furniture. As for what to do with the nuclear waste, right now the waste is already in being stored, and it's not clear what's the best way to deal with that waste. But it clearly is not the solution to put it into products that you and I can use every day.
That's Lexi Schultz, staff attorney for U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Coalition members say the buildings designated for cleanup do not pose a high risk to public health and could be maintained safely until environmentally and economically acceptable projects are developed. As we heard last week in our look at President Clinton's budget for next year, environmentalists as well as some members of Green Scissors say underpaid royalties by oil companies drilling on public lands and timber companies harvesting on public lands are two subsidies they want to see cut and expect them to be hotly debated this year. Whether or not these programs are eliminated, Lexi Schultz says Green Scissors has reduced wasteful spending.
In the 5 years of the Green Scissors campaign, PERG and our coalition partners like Friends of the Earth and Taxpayers for Common Sense have helped to eliminate more than $24 billion worth of polluter pork programs. And as an example, by eliminating unneeded and dangerous nuclear programs, we've stopped more than $19 billion of taxpayer money from being nuked.
Green Scissors members say they try to meet with congressmen and women to discuss what they call polluter pork programs. Sina Swisher says in the past, the coalition has received support from Representatives Petrie of Wisconsin, George Miller of California, Bernie Sanders from Vermont, and a number of senators. Swisher says people often ask why cutting wasteful spending that hurts the environment is important at a time when there is a budget surplus.
Well, first of all, it's a projected budget surplus. and we still carry a national debt of over $5 trillion. And the projected surplus is partly based on budget cuts. And this is where Green Scissors 99 fits in perfectly because we have 72 budget cuts right here, right now. And wasteful spending is still rampant in Washington. Happens every day.
You can find more information about Green Scissors 99 on your personal computer. Go to www.foe.org. That's www.foe.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be discussing a subject which affects everyone listening to this program that either breathes air or who has ever bought a product in the marketplace, and that is the diesel engine. Diesels power the tractors on our farm, many of the buses and trains that we ride to work, and the trucks that bring all of that stuff to the malls and shopping centers that we buy and consume every day. Anybody that's followed a trailer truck uphill has seen black smoke that comes out of some diesel engines, and so it's no surprise that regulating diesel exhaust emissions has been a key strategy in air pollution control programs in just about all developed countries. And while the health effects of diesel exhaust have been subject of research for years, the Board of Science Counselors of the National Toxicology Program, that's a federal science body, recently recommended that diesel fumes be added to the list of federal carcinogenic substances. And what they said was that diesel fumes were, quote, reasonably anticipated, unquote, to cause cancer. This follows a determination that a panel of state scientists in California made last year when they said that diesel poses a serious cancer threat. And as a result of that, the California Air Resources Board has been taking action to curb emissions. So we understand that the EPA is likely to impose stricter limits on some diesels in particularly sport utility vehicles and light trucks in the next round of standards, which is scheduled to be published in March. And so to figure all of this out, what needs to be done, how much of a threat do we really face, I've invited three guests to help us figure this out. Jerry Martin is spokesman for the California Air Resources Board, and he's in Sacramento. Glenn Keller is Executive Director of the Engine Manufacturers Association. That's the trade group that represents companies that builds diesel engines. And Frank O'Donnell, he's Executive Director of the Clean Air Trust, which is a nonprofit environmental organization based in Washington, D.C. So, Jerry Martin from the California Air Resources Board, let's start with you. How serious a health threat does your agency think is posed by diesel engines, and what have you been doing about it?
Well, Last August, the Air Resources Board identified diesel particulate, the fine particles that are part of the exhaust, as a toxic air contaminant. In essence, what that means is we think that that part of the diesel exhaust causes cancer. We have been on a long 30-year effort to reduce emissions from diesel vehicles, in part because of our suspicion of its cancer-causing ability, and also because diesel engines emit an enormous amount of other air pollutants, and California is the nation's most polluted state.
Now, Glenn Keller from the Manufacturers Association, my recollection is that when the California findings were made, the manufacturers challenged the science, basically did not agree with the conclusions about the cancer-causing effect. Is that still the position of the manufacturers? Will they be challenging EPA, for example?
Well, yes, Peter. I think it's very important to put this this issue in context. Although there's been a lot of research done on diesel engine exhaust and what its potential harmful effects could be on human beings, what's missing from this analysis is that all of the studies done to date have been with old engines, engines older than 15 to 20 years old. It's been done with old formulations of diesel fuel, which substantially skew some of the information we're getting from these studies, because the brand new engines that we are exposed to on the streets today are much cleaner, and the fuels have been reconstituted over time, so we have cleaner formulations of diesel fuel being run in these engines. And I think the point that we need to, that is of extreme skepticism in the scientific researchers' world, is the fact that no data or study that's been done to date has indicated something unique in diesel-fueled exhaust that poses a human cancer threat.
Let's hear from Frank O'Donnell from the Clean Air Trust on the health issue. Is, in fact, a lot of this data based on old machines that, I guess, presumptively are less in use now?
Well, I think some of the studies have been done with old machines, but we're talking about not different chemicals, but different concentrations of the chemicals. Let me start by congratulating Mr. Martin's agency for the landmark work they've done to promote the cause of clean air. I know they take Knox from environmentalists at some point, but I also want you to know you're appreciated, not only in California, but because the standards and programs you put in place do have an impact on the rest of us. And this issue is, once again, an area where you're on the cutting edge. California essentially said diesel particulate, diesel smoke, is a health problem. And I think it's a problem that's going to be increasingly recognized as a health issue in the rest of the country. Now, let me just say, the listeners know what we're talking about here with diesel smoke. Mr. Keller, his arguments sound a little bit like those of the tobacco industry when they say smoking doesn't cause cancer. Never been proved. The particles we're talking about are very small, little pieces of carbon. Some of them are so small you can't even see them. We can see the smoke, but some of these particles that are part of this exhaust are even smaller. And they're coated with toxic chemicals, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Now, some of these particles are so small that they, as doctors explain it to me, they go right through the body's defense mechanisms. They go through the nose, down the throat, into the lungs, and they carry these chemicals with them. And these tiny particles can become embedded in our lungs, scar our lungs, and lead to a shortened life.
So, Glenn Keller, are you suggesting that the newer engines don't do this, or the concentrations are less, or this is not a problem?
Well, the concentrations are dramatically less, Peter. In fact, there are newer engines for the over the last 10 years. We reduced the exposure to particles by 90%. The particulate levels are much lower in our new engines ever since 1994. And similarly, we've reduced the NOx concentrations from our engines by 70%. So we've been making great strides on this, and the engine manufacturers are very proud of the developments they've been able to affect over time in reducing the incidence of this problem, and we're willing to do more. But I do take issue with trying to compare us to the tobacco industry, because our messages are very, very different.
Jerry Merton from California, is this a problem that solves itself as the old engines get cycled out, or is your agency taking action that affects current engines that are now being built?
Well,
Well, I think the answer to that is twofold. Yes, the problem will be reduced as newer engines that are cleaner begin to show themselves in the marketplace and on our roads. However, there are a huge number of older engines, not only on the road, but in California's fields and agricultural equipment and construction equipment, and many of those engines do not meet the current-day standards, which, as Mr. Keller said, are much tighter than they were even 5 years ago.
So what is California doing about the old ones?
We have several programs in place. One that this agency is running has $25 million set aside to replace older diesel engines with new technology, preferably some alternative fuel, compressed natural gas, or at least the cleanest diesel engines that are available. We also have adopted standards for new motor vehicles that begin in 2004 that closed a loophole that was originally in those standards that would have allowed additional SUVs, sports utility vehicles, and large pickups to be imported into California. We expected a lot of those to be diesel, and now those vehicles will have to pretty much meet the same standards as any gas-powered engine.
Frank O'Donnell from
sure.
the Clean Air Trust, let me ask you something. If the old machines are taken off the road or out of the fields or cleaned up, does the kind of technology that Glenn Keller is talking about that's being put into new machines solve our problem? Are we really just waiting for the old ones to disappear? Or from your perspective, do we have to go farther to get air at an acceptable health level?
To get air that's really clean, we're going to have to go farther. Mr. Keller's right. The engines are cleaner than they were, but they need to be a lot cleaner. In fact, they can be a lot cleaner. And I'll talk about why and how. And in fact, he and I are going to be in agreement, I believe, on some of these points, because it does pertain to the fuel quality. But it's, as far as the cleanliness of the air right now, absolutely we have a long way to go. Right now in urban areas in particular, diesel exhaust, and we're talking mainly about buses and trucks there, not that many diesel cars on the road, are the biggest source of fine particle soot, which the EPA has decreed can shorten your life. In New York City, for example, I believe that the statistics are that diesel exhaust is about 60% of this fine particle soot. So it's a very large volume of it, and it's a very real health issue. It's not just a hypothetical, and that's the standard today.
And so what are cities like New York and Chicago and other places with lots of buses, what are they to do?
Well, some of them are looking at some stopgap measures, like trying to retrofit buses or change to alternate fuels, as Mr. Martin talked about. I mean, part of the answer really is a long-term phase-out. And I guess I really ought to make it clear that from the standpoint of the environmental community, I'd probably be viewed as a moderate. I'm not calling on a total ban on the diesel engine, but a lot of environmental groups are. They're ginning up what they call dump diesel campaigns, and they'd like to ban diesel engines entirely. To them, the phrase clean diesel is something on akin with safe nuclear. I tend to be optimistic that we can develop technology to make the diesels a lot cleaner than they are today, and it ought to be a national priority to make it happen. One thing that we desperately need is cleaner fuel. Mr. Keller's right, the fuel is a little better than it was 10 years ago, but we need to do much more in terms of taking the pollutant sulfur out of diesel fuel. Sulfur is like dirt or like a poison in the fuel. It really puts a barrier to certain kinds of pollution control technologies.
Well, a few weeks ago, we did a program on just that issue. It was pointed out that if you could take the sulfur out of gas and take that down to California standards, catalytic converters on cars would work a lot better, and it would have the impact of taking almost a fifth of the vehicle fleet
off the road.
Now, is there a similar gain? Glenn Keller, your guys make these things. Is there a similar gain that could be achieved if cleaner fuel were being sold for the existing fleet of diesels?
Peter, the answer to that is absolutely. Frank O'Donnell has picked up on an initiative that the engine manufacturers are working with US EPA and our oil refining industry right now to try to get ultra-low levels of sulfur content in the diesel fuel. And if I think the best comparison I can make for you is that back in the mid-70s, we had to take lead out of our gasoline to enable auto manufacturers to utilize a new and burgeoning technology called catalytic converters. we have the same opportunities in the heavy-duty diesel market today to utilize catalyst technology to use as an after-treatment device to help reduce the amount of ozone-creating emissions and particulate emissions and helping in trimming off
so
the toxics.
Does that mean that the manufacturers as well as the environmentalists are together taking on the oil companies on this one?
I certainly hope to embrace them in this policy move because it is a dramatic expense for the oil refining industry that we appreciate, but we also note that they need to be partners in our efforts to cleaning up the air of America.
Frank, how hard is the environmental community working with the manufacturers to take on the oil people?
Well, we're not working with them in the sense of having meetings and plotting and things like that, but we do favor a similar position. And the real reasons for the environment why we would, let me give you an example. I've seen some test results talking about the use of low-sulfur fuel in a big diesel engine vehicle. And that in combination with a cleanup device called a filter or a trap reduces the diesel particulate by 90% or more compared to even the new engines that are going out on the road today.
We are running out of time.
It's very important to have this fuel.
We're running out of time, and I'd like to close with you, Jerry Martin, from California. We've been talking about diesel emissions. When you look at the whole potpourri of smog in a place like Los Angeles, how much of that and how much of the pollution is diesel-related? Is this a big chunk of the chemical stew out there?
Oh, absolutely. The figures that Mr. O'Donnell gave earlier for New York match very closely with those we have in California, where roughly 30% of all of our motor vehicle nitrogen oxides, which is a precursor to a huge amount of other pollution problems, including ozone, come from diesel vehicle emissions, and about 60% of all the motor vehicle particulate.
Okay. Well, on that note, I'm afraid our time is up. We've been discussing the diesel engine and air pollution cancer problems associated with it. My guests have been Jerry Martin from the California Air Resources Board, which has moved aggressively on this issue, Glenn Keller from the Engine Manufacturers Association. His group represents the folks that build diesel engines, and Frank O'Donnell from the Clean Air Trust. We're interested in your views on this issue. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. If you go to our website, you can hear The Environment Show anytime. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Desertification, or loss of vegetation and fertile land due to dryness, is a major problem facing the African continent, where each year stretches of previously productive land becomes desert. This was the focus of a recent international conference in Dakar, the capital of Senegal, a country located on the western coast of Africa. One of the countries of the conference was Switzerland, which is committed to fighting desertification. From Swiss Radio International, Susan Emmett reports.
In the shade of a mango tree, villagers of Ndurop village in central Senegal welcome visitors to witness their struggle to prevent further degradation of their land. This year's harvest of peanuts and millet was even worse than last year. A third of the world's farmland is dry land like theirs and at risk of desertification. Henri Philippe Carr, Assistant Director General of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, recognizes the seriousness of these and other villages' situations.
The struggle against desertification is for us of the utmost importance. The Swiss Development Cooperation is working in some concentration countries, and especially in the Sahel region. There, desertification is a main problem, like food security. But food security and desertification are linked together.
While many farmers are doing what they can, the enormity of the task ahead on the African continent, as well as in Asia and South America, needs investment, substantial investment. But Henri Philippe Carr is not enthusiastic about special programs of spending on the soil.
I am against special programs. I think all our program, forestation, sure, but also water management, but also, say, a school program. In the curricula, you need to teach the children what they can do to protect nature. Desertification is a total struggle which touches each and every action you can take.
Senegalese farmers struggle to make a living on the land, and on the coast, traditional fishing communities are finding it just as hard to survive. At dusk, fishermen return from their sea with their catch. Prices to them, though, are rarely good, even though catches are down. Under fishing agreements with European and Asian countries, Senegal allows foreign fleets to scoop up the fish off its shore and the profits. Jean Ziegler, a Swiss parliamentarian and lecturer in development issues, sees this as yet another example of how global trade, together with land degradation or desertification, brings poverty rather than riches to those selling their resources.
Globalization brings impoverishment. The exodus from the countryside is absolutely incredible. If you see, yes, Dakar, there are now 62 slums, and the population of the city of Dakar is over 2 million today of displaced persons by desertification. And the state has less and less money to make a social policy, to create in the countryside the social infrastructure necessary to keep the people there.
One way to alleviate poverty in coastal and rural areas and to help halt problems such as overfishing and desertification is to increase producers' power in the marketplace. Selling collectively could be one option, says Henri Philippe Carr, and there are others.
A very important project is to have storehouses in the place of the villages. So I think this is very important to help the farmers to organize themselves, to know how to react to the market, to try to have concurrence in the market so that you have fair price. Now, also, if you can process the products within the country, you will also add value to the product in the country itself.
That was Susie Emmett from Swiss Radio International reporting from Senegal, Africa. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you think life originated in a backyard meth lab, you better listen to the show again. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 477. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.